What artificial intelligence sees in our poems? This evening, I asked a computer program to create a list of poems that help people wake up out of indoctrination. And it found some patterns that would not be obvious, certainly not to a person that is already set where the common meaning of those poems is concerned. The poems you are about to hear came up first, and I hope that you don't mind that I give a brief introduction to each. It is all too easy to lose ourselves to the meanings that aren't the highest to be found. All of these poems just talk about one single thing. Growing all the way up until we all become great beings and converge on wisdom in world peace and finally end poverty. In my preparation this morning, the artificial intelligence also shared a quote by Mahatma Gandhi. Poverty is the worst form of violence. This first poem is about my America. Immigrants always have a stunning and undying vision of United States and the whole developed world. In fact, when I think about this nation, I don't think about a chunk of land. I think about the United States of the world. To me, this is the nation that learns to understand that criminals are simply indoctrinated into a life of crime and violence and already punished by the deathly squeeze of poverty. I still believe that ours will be the first nation to help criminals to therapy and real education, and that eventually we will be greatly ashamed by the torture of prisons. I further believe that United States will be the first to implement an extremely powerful universal basic income program that will simply end poverty in a snap. From that point on, we will have the mind that will help us realize we are not learning in schools, only pretending so that we can get a job. And then we will swiftly fix education. The New Colossus by Emma Lazarus. An 1883 sonnet, lines of which are engraved on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here, at our sea-washed sunset gates, shall stand a mighty woman, with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name is Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, you storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, the tempest tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The next poem is about a religious concept, but I mention it because there is a second layer to comprehending it. After all, we did invent religions. When we stand above indoctrination, we can see that it creates passive systems that collect a little bit of coin from a lot of people in exchange for peace of mind. And wherever there is evil present, this also eases people into obedience and servitude and without violence. It's a terrible thing what religions have gotten away with in the past. The level of danger that comes with indoctrination is dictated by its creators, by the hosts. Religion, for many of us, is a pretty distant thing to critique. Let me give you something that is extremely dangerous to all people of Earth, and that is currently ongoing. And that is mandatory military service, almost the same thing as religion. Especially dangerous in countries that have no resources other than nuclear weapons to fight their wars. So here, the end of the poem is about made-up religions, but also political and military systems. This is the rocking of the cradle and the rough beast. This is not a sad poem. This is a poem aimed to inspire us, to remind us to grow all the way up. The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats, 1919. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosened upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosened, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming, hardly are those words out. When a vast image out of the Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with a lion body and the head of a man. A gaze, blank and pitiless as the sun is moving its slow ties, while all about it, real shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and that the rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. In the next poem, we talk about a vile creature just like this one. A creature we call the tiger. And we wonder about its creator. We have created the tiger. Out of lack of education, out of lack of greatness. It no longer serves as a deterrent. I don't think it ever did. but rather an option for mad lunatics. I think of this poem as a challenge, because we are still stuck in the mindset of fighting wars. What a stupid thing that is. We still have fools that say, how could possibly both sides lose? Well, you twats, without the war, you may be asking the other side to go out with you for dinner. How can you not see that? The war has taken so much. We brought these fools into a world so blind that they cannot conceive of this question even, of what could have been, had we used schools to rise far above conflict and into world peace. Instead, schools today merely sell an impression of education. Where are your computer programs? Where is your music from the music class? Where are your startups? Is a Monday 9 to 5 all you're going to do? Where are your books and poems? They are gone because the schools were fake. The Tiger by William Blake, 1794. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burned the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer? What the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil? What dread grasp? There its deadly terrors clasp. When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? You know, this poem is not to be taken lightly. I would remind all of you that we were each born into a world that had nuclear weapons pointed at our heads. This is not a good world. This is a bad idea. It's a really mad idea. There's a very good reason why I'm asking each and every one of you to rise to become great beings. You are charged with making repairs and helping the world restart in the right direction. This next poem is from year 1818. It speaks about how fleeting mad things are. That all this posturing and might and border and war really wants is to be forgotten, to dust. Humanity has just one single path forward, ending poverty, fixing schools, and bettering ourselves far beyond world peace and convergence of wisdom, so that never again will we be victims of indoctrination into poverty and fake education, or chasing happiness, which is darn impossible. Happiness cannot be pursued. It is not a thing you can hold in your hand. Happiness is a result of growing all the way up. It's the result of greatness. To paraphrase Dr. Frankl, happiness must ensue as the byproduct of something greater. In a word, this poem explains that if we don't rise against madness, then history will bury us beneath the fallen statues of madmen. Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley, 1818. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the stand, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on the lifeless things, the hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Nothing besides remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. In the final poem of this literary adventure, we speak of something that I have personally actually done. And Mr. Yeats is completely, fully correct. Not once, since I left the first beaches that I traveled to alone, just to escape lies and manipulations and indoctrinations, did I not feel the warmth of the ocean? I am still standing there, knee-deep in the waters of Veterans Beach, at the edge of the universe that stems from the water and warps all around, helping me see that I have been rewarded with spending a beautiful moment right at the beautiful edge of the universe, where I could turn right around and see the world completely. I recorded my first real poem there, with the same microcassette recorder that once helped me navigate New York subways to my magnificent, though slightly overblown, peril. I have never left the beach. Whoever you are, listen to what you really hear in your concrete jungles and the gibberish of nonsense. The things in the back of your mind. Find your mountains. Find your oceans. Find your riverboat or pontoon even. Or build one out of barrels so that you can float down the Mississippi. Walk. Walk the world's great trails. Start with the Appalachian Trail and go all the way around the world till you reach the Continental Divide. You are far too beautiful for a lifetime of confusion or overwork or stress, or anything that isn't worthy of who you truly should become. Talk to your older self. Ask them what their regrets are. The Lake Isle of Innisfree by W.B. Yeats, 1892. I will arise now and go to Innisfree, in a small cabin built there, of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There, midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now. For always, night and day, I hear the lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. And that almost concludes the reading of this evening's poems. But the long list goes on. You shouldn't ever think of a poet as a mere artist that spins words together. No poet that has ever writ wasn't a philosopher. It's how they hide. Remember your first and foremost duty in life, please. You are to grow all the way up, not part way up, but all the way until you become a great being. This is the only way that the world can follow. We are each meant to become great beings. And I'm sorry, I just couldn't bring myself to end here. The moment I arrived at the finale, I couldn't say that it was the conclusion. There's just 2 more things, two more things. First, a word from Henry Thoreau. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not when it came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation, unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. To live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life. To cut a broad swath and shave close. To drive life into a corner and reduce it into its lowest terms. And one more, just one last poem. Walt Whitman. The artificial intelligence wouldn't know that Walt Whitman is the great finale. He has to come at the end with his beautiful poem, Cosmos. Who includes diversity and is nature, who is the amplitude of the earth and the coarseness and sexuality of the earth and the great charity of the earth and the equilibrium also, who has not looked forth from the windows the eyes for nothing, or whose brain held audience with messengers for nothing, who contains believers and disbelievers, who is the most majestic lover, who holds duly his or her triune proportion of realism, spiritualism, and of the aesthetic or intellectual, who, having considered the body, finds all its organs and parts good, who out of the theory of the earth and of his or her body understands by subtle analogies all other theories. The theory of a city, a poem, and of the large politics of these states. Who believes not only in our globe with its sun and moon, but in other globes with their suns and moons. Who, constructing the house of himself or herself, not for a day, but for all time, sees races, eras, dates, generations, the past, the future, dwelling there like space, inseparable together.